Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
In its promotional video, Jackson Memorial Hospital boasts about its proximity to the Caribbean islands.
The hospital is within 3 hours' reach by air ambulance plane from almost anywhere in the Caribbean Basin and Central America, making it easily accessible from anywhere in the entire region.
The problem? That means it's one of the closest hospitals to Haiti, and it's taken in hundreds of patients with traumatic injuries. Florida Governor Charlie Crist says the cost of treating Haitians has been staggering.
After about 3 days, it was about $1.7 million. After about a week, it was $7.1 million. And we're probably at approximately $10 million to date.
Haiti doesn't have $10 million. But guess what? Neither does Florida. Who pays for the treatment of Haitians? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 2nd, and The Takeaway from me is here we have a completely new and tragic twist on the healthcare debate.
Yes, and there is no healthcare infrastructure in Haiti, and
none.
The U.S. steps up to the plate, and it costs definitely money. Let's get right to the top stories we're following. Haiti is our top story. Haitian officials are considering a trial for those 10 Americans arrested while trying to take children out of Haiti without proper documents. The Haitian prime minister says the Americans knew they were breaking the law, especially since some of the children have surviving parents. This orphanage spokesperson quotes one of the kids who reportedly told him,
"I'm not an orphan. I do have my parents. I thought I'm going to a boarding school or to a summer camp. We don't know it exactly, to the Dominican Republic."
No charges have been officially filed yet, but Haitian officials say prosecution is needed to help deter child trafficking.
This comes as the U.S. military says it will now fly injured earthquake survivors to several states. That's to avoid overloading Florida. That's treated an overwhelming majority of the victims so far. For more on that, we're joined by Dr. Mark McKinney. He's the medical director at Ryder Trauma Center and the chief of surgery at the University of Miami Hospital. Good morning, Dr. McKinney.
Good morning, Celeste.
What kinds of injuries are the people coming into the hospital? What are you treating them for?
Generally, after a catastrophe like this, we have two types of injuries: severe internal injuries and severe external injuries. All the patients with severe internal injuries died the first night because there was no one there to help. And we're seeing the severe external injuries like extremity fractures and gangrene.
And I assume also some burns and crushing injuries as well. How long does someone generally have to stay in the hospital? A number of weeks?
Yeah, we have a model that estimates they'll be in the hospital for 10 days to 2 weeks at about $50,000 per patient.
And then they go back to Haiti and they're self-sufficient, or they need regular medical care?
Well, that's a good question. We see it as two groups. Those with simple fractures who get casted will probably be able to go back to Haiti and just need crutches. And then there's a second group that had gangrene, which often led to amputations, and some of them have developed renal failure secondary to their gangrene. This is going to be difficult to get them back to Haiti. They need ongoing rehab. They need prosthesis. They'll probably suffer post-traumatic stress disorder. So that group's not going to be able to get back to Haiti easily.
It's not going to be cheap whether they go or stay. Dr. McKinney, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
The answer to Toyota's recall problems, we learn, is a small steel shim the size of a postage stamp. Those little shims will start arriving at Toyota dealerships across the country today. And the process of adding them to recalled cars to fix their defective accelerator pedals should begin by the weekend. There are reports that the recall's cost to Toyota is at least $1 billion up front.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates announces today a year-long review of the impact of lifting the ban on gays in the military, and it's not time to put away your coats. Groundhog Day, last hour, Punxsutawney Phil came out to check for his shadow, and
as the sky shines bright above me, my shadow I see beside me. Winter continues for six more weeks,
and the markets continue. Futures are up right now. The Dow will start at 10,185, the S&P at 1,089, and the NASDAQ at 2,171. So we're asking you throughout this show, if you have an unemployed friend, what's the best way you can help them? Or if you're unemployed, what kind of help do you want? We're going to be talking about that later this hour, and we're asking for your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, medical costs for treating people from Haiti.
Survivors of the Haitian earthquake are still being airlifted right now to Florida hospitals, hopefully to hospitals in other states as well. And they're being treated in American hospitals, and those American hospitals right now are shouldering those costs. But the question is, who will shoulder the burden of the cost of treatment now and in the future? Joining us now again is Dr. Mark McKenney. He's the chief of surgery at the University of Miami Hospital. And Dr. Aneta Roldan is the president and CEO of Jackson Health System, the only public health care system in Miami. Dr. Roldan, you heard Dr. McKenney talking about the fact that they estimate it costs $50,000 per patient for the treatment of injuries sustained during the earthquake. Who's paying for that right now?
Good morning, Celeste. Well, right now we have basically two groups. We have the first group were basically U.S. Haitian U.S. citizens, and many of them, a good 90% of them, were covered by insurance. That cost to date is approximately $2.2 million in charges. Those will be sent to a third-party payer. Then you've got the second group, which mostly came in subsequent flights, of of Haitian nationals, and those charges up to date is approximately $2.3 million. As of yesterday, we did receive notice that through the NDMS, we will probably be able to have some reimbursement at approximately 110% of Medicare rates for those patients that do not have any other coverage. But before yesterday, we did not have any confirmation. We were able to be in touch and communicate almost on a daily basis with both state and federal agencies, as well as our state senators and Congress. But as of yesterday, we did not have any other confirmation.
So up until today, you said it's cost somewhere above $2 million. Will that get reimbursed by the federal government through this program that you're talking about that they announced yesterday?
Well, we don't know if this is going to be retroactive. One of the things that we are doing from day one is being able to track the cost of the patients, but we don't know if this is going to be retroactive. We know that this is as of yesterday, so it is moving forward. I will continue, though, to work with both our state and our federal agencies to see how we can get reimbursed for the charges that already have been at cost to the system.
And Dr. McKenney, you actually traveled to Haiti and recently returned from there. How many patients have been airlifted out of Haiti to American hospitals?
Total of about 500, of which 350 have gone to Florida and about 150 have gone to the Ryder Trauma Center at Jackson Memorial Hospital. So we're overwhelmingly getting the majority of the patients in the state, and our hospital alone have taken more patients than the rest of the country.
And are you still able to accommodate the American patients that you have?
Absolutely. Our mission requires that we treat the Americans first, but we've all been working overtime, extra shifts, volunteering our time in order to be able to take care of both groups. It's quite a strain.
And have you sent any of these patients back to Haiti?
No, as of right now, we haven't. Some of the more modest injuries, though, could start to be sent back soon.
Dr. Aneta Roldan of the Jackson Health System, how many patients have come into your health system from Haiti?
Approximately as of Saturday, Jackson Health System has treated 137 patients who were injured during the earthquake. And of those, 98 have already been discharged. And the majority have been treated at Jackson, Maine. As you know, Jackson Health System is a system of six hospitals, which includes our children's hospital. At the children's hospital, about 42 children have been treated at the Children's Hospital, and 35 of them have been discharged as of current.
They suspended airlifts for several days because Florida hospitals said they were being overwhelmed. Are your hospitals overwhelmed?
No, one of the things that we are doing on a daily basis, we watch very closely our bed capacity as well as our resources, which include our own staff. Because we are spread throughout three campuses, what we have done is use the resources across the health system, and only the patients that really need that have catastrophic injuries and need the trauma center will stay at Jackson Maine, which have been a good majority of them. But we've also used our resources at Jackson North and Jackson South, which are multi-specialty community hospitals.
Dr. McKenney, as a trauma surgeon, You know, you sort of raised the issue that when you send people back to Haiti with some of these injuries that are going to require perhaps even lifelong rehab, how do you evaluate the release date of some of these patients when you know, unlike releasing them into the South Florida area, that they're not going to have rehab opportunities and maybe you're going to have to keep them longer?
Which is exactly what's happening, both here in Miami, and we have a hospital, a tent hospital set up in Haiti, and the same things are happening. We're trying to make decisions based on not what would normally happen, but what's going to happen to this special group because the care and the long-term follow-up is unclear.
And you know, a lot of people have been telling us this week, what does Haiti need that's going to help it long-term? It sounds like there should be investments on those kinds of long-term chronic care sorts of facilities in Haiti as much as they need the trauma relief and the $50,000 per bed cost that you're paying.
Yeah, they need food, shelter, and they need a functioning hospital, hopefully which we can switch over and be staffed by Haitians. We've actually taken over one of the other hospitals in Haiti because all the Haitian surgeons were killed in the earthquake. So unlike we've been to all the disasters, Katrina, New Orleans, Oklahoma, New York, Quito, Turkey, and unlike all the others, what happened is they needed a helping hand. They got on their feet in a couple of weeks, and then we transitioned the care to the local country personnel. In Haiti, that's not happening. Many of the surgeons and nurses were killed. The hospitals are not functioning normally, and it's a difficult transition.
So in these other cases where you've dealt with survivors of disasters, how long was that transition?
Usually 2 weeks.
And certainly in this case, it could be a matter of months.
Yeah, it's already been going on 4 weeks. We don't have a clear mechanism to transfer all the care over to the Haitian community in Haiti.
Well, right. And the takeaway is he's saying it's not happening at all. That's really disturbing, Dr. McKinney.
Yeah, the opposite is actually happening now. The Haitians are starting to identify us as the caregivers and are starting to send over more patients. Uh-huh. So the exit strategy is not clear. We're on the ground right now, but we need to help set up Haitians who can take care of the Haitian people.
That is Dr. Mark McKinney, Medical Director at Ryder Trauma Center and the Chief of Surgery at the University of Miami Hospital. We also spoke with Dr. Anita Roldan, President and CEO of Jackson Health System. So at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the news headlines.
Toyota is going to use stamp-sized pieces of steel to fix vehicles affected in their worldwide recall of 4.5 million vehicles. The fix should take less than an hour per car. The recall is costing the automaker about $155 million a week in lost sales. That doesn't even include the cost of the recall. President Obama, in another story, wants Congress to approve his nearly $4 trillion budget plan. His proposal calls for a record $1.6 trillion deficit. Today, the president is selling his program in New Hampshire to talk about the small business credit programs.
In healthcare, lawmakers in 34 states are moving ahead with constitutional amendments to ban government health insurance requirements. They say penalties against people who refuse to carry health insurance is a violation of individual rights. And New Orleans is getting pumped for the Super Bowl.
We have it!
That's a popular cheer by New Orleans Saints fans. Now, Louisiana's attorney general says shops can sell T-shirts with the phrase, "Who dat?" But they can't reference the New Orleans Saints or the NFL. The NFL had tried to block sales of things carrying that phrase. But the NFL says they only objected to shirts that were marketed as a Saints or NFL product. So that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. We're going to be talking about Super Bowl ads, speaking of the Saints, and how activist commercials are making a first-time appearance in the big game. That's in a few minutes. And later in this hour, we're going to talk about how to help our friends and loved ones who are unemployed. If you know someone who is unemployed, how do you help them? Or maybe you yourself are unemployed. How can we help you? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Hey, you want that to go?
a historical takeout here to begin. Back in the 1980s, the economically troubled 1980s, if you had a political argument about the deficit, it was usually the dweebiest person at the table who would point out, yeah, but the deficit's only like 2% of GDP, so it really doesn't matter.
Nice impression.
But in the Obama administration, the number that is going to have much higher visibility is this $1.6 trillion deficit is projected to be 11% of this nation's entire economic output. And it's a very serious issue, according to David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, author of The Inheritance, a book that's just out in paperback. Good morning, David.
Good morning, John. This is Revenge of the Dweebs morning. Huh?
Indeed. Well, but I mean, now I think the fact that this is an 11% number rather than a 2 or a 3% number suddenly puts it into circulation, and we're really talking about something serious here.
You know, we are, and let's put this in a little bit of perspective. During three different wars, we ran deficits that, as a country, that were above 11% during the Civil War, World War One, and World War Two. But it was always with the expectation that the war was going to end, that spending on the war would dramatically reduce, and therefore this was a temporary thing. What's different about the 11% we're seeing now is that the two wars that we're involved in are, by comparison, relatively low-level wars. And what's causing this is not only the spending to get out of the recession, but also, over time, the entitlements. So when you look at the budget that President Obama sent to the Hill yesterday, what's interesting isn't just the 11%. It comes down in a few years. But by 2019, 2020, it goes back up. And it never sort of gets below 4 or 5%.
So you describe that these are not sustainable levels. And indeed, when the war ended, it went down, but it's not going down here. What does that mean exactly? I mean, can the world's biggest borrower stay a superpower?
Yeah, I mean, a sustainable deficit is when over time your productivity outpaces the degree at which you're spending. I mean, same thing. For your home budget. You know, it's always nice if you may run big debt some years, but it's always nice if over time this levels out. And that's not happening in the U.S. budget. And so the question I raised in this piece is a question that Larry Summers, who is now the president's chief economic advisor, used to raise before he went into government, which is how long can the world's biggest borrower also be the world's biggest power?
Well, if he's,
you know, the Chinese are betting not long.
But is Summers betting maybe for a long time, since he's presumably behind part of this budget?
Yeah, and the part of this budget that he's behind is he believes that you need to do this kind of big deficit spending in a time of high unemployment and to keep the economy chugging. So he doesn't have a huge problem with the temporary 11% of GDP. But I think everybody in the administration who I've talked to, though they won't say much about this on the record, has a very hard time with the out years of, you know, 5, 6, 7% of GDP. That's the part that's not sustainable. And that's where our political gridlock between Republicans who won't raise taxes and Democrats who won't cut entitlements is really beginning to cost us.
So you write that this budget deserves some credit for its candor. I wonder if we can do some, like, magical math here. Is there a way to, like, peel off the Afghan and Iraq wars and all of a sudden we don't have a deficit anymore, or peel off some of the entitlements?
It's a very good question. You could peel off the Afghan and Iraq wars and you still have a deficit, and
wow,
you still have a pretty big one. I mean, they're expensive, but they're not the biggest part of this deficit by a long shot.
And the Chinese are betting we can't do this for long? That sounds kind of scary, David.
Well, their long-term bet, you know, if you've been around as long as the Chinese have, you know, a 200-year-old, 250-year-old country doesn't seem all that, you know, impressive, right? And their bet is that over time, we're not going to be able to spend, the U.S. will not be able to spend, to spread American influence around the world the way we did in the 50s and the 60s when we were fighting communism. One of the things I discuss at length in The Inheritance is how they have, in fact, used the period of time when we were distracted by Iraq to begin to do exactly that kind of spending in Southeast Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, so that they tie up countries with exclusive oil deals, building capitals in developing countries, they're doing what we did quite well in the 50s and 60s to begin
Indeed.
To spread their influence around the world.
Well, shrinking capital, growing influence. It's the story that, David Sanger tells in the New York Times today. And, of course, his book, The Inheritance, out in paperback. Thanks so much, David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times.
Coming up on the show, we're going to be talking about how do you help the unemployed, or if you're unemployed, what kind of help do you need? And we're getting some great stories from you. If you know someone who's unemployed, what's the number one thing you're offering, or what do you need if you don't have a job?
My name is Joe Dendo, calling from Washington, Michigan. The way I help the loved one is I found him a job.
Hey, it's Michelle calling from Atlanta. The one thing that I would like for my friends to do since I'm laid off is not call me at 8 in the morning asking what I'm doing.
Erica writes on our site. I know, it's great.
Calling Michelle.
I've been self-employed for months. I've been trying to find a full-time job. One thing my employed friends constantly ask me that's not helpful at all is, have you heard anything about that job? And it tends to be a solicitous, anxious tone of voice that makes the question sting even more. Stop, workers of the world, cut us some slack. Stop asking if we've heard about the million and one jobs that we and the other 10% of the population have applied for. I guarantee that when I get a job, I will tell everyone I know.
That's what Facebook is for. Jeff writes back, I'm unemployed for the first time in my life, and while some of my friends have been respectful, others have taken the opportunity to act like mother hens, asking, have you done so-and-so yet? Over and over and over again. While they're asking is, I hope, good-intentioned, it's more aggravating and disheartening instead of helpful.
Let's
Great
get your
stuff.
Story. I know. I guess it's your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can post it on our website, thetakeaway.org. We're going to talk about it more later this hour. Coming up, the president wants to overhaul the No Child Left Behind Act. We're going to talk about what this means for educators and students in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, change is a-coming to the No Child Left Behind Act. We'll see what that looks like at the schoolhouse level. More in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. President Obama's budget may face an early test this week on Capitol Hill. The proposed tax credit for small businesses could come up for a vote in the Senate by Friday. In the meantime, the president is urging Congress to pass his budget, even though that means raising the federal deficit to $1.6 trillion.
It's time to save what we can, spend what we must, and live within our means once again.
The president is selling his program up in New Hampshire today, promoting the idea of spending $30 billion on community banks so they can help small businesses. In Haiti, the United Nations estimates that almost 500,000 people have fled Port-au-Prince since last month's devastating earthquake.
Staying in Haiti, officials there are considering a trial for the 10 Americans arrested while trying to take children out of the country illegally. The Haitian prime minister says the Americans knew they were breaking the law since some of the children have surviving parents. Pastor Drew Hamm, whose parishioners are among the detained, tells CBS News that his group had no malicious intentions.
I know the hearts of those folks that went to Haiti, and their heart was to help combat the problem of human trafficking. And so certainly this would never be something that they would be a part of, at least those things that they're charged of doing.
No charges have been filed yet against the group. The only crash involving a Concorde supersonic airliner is at the heart of a long-awaited trial getting underway in France today. The accident in July of 2002 killed 113 people. The official report said the Concorde hit a piece of metal that had fallen off a Continental Airlines plane, then caught fire and crashed. Continental Airlines and five individuals were charged with manslaughter. All of them deny any wrongdoing. Looking at the markets, futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,185, the S&P at 1,089, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,171. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
So you may recall, early in this decade, one of the very early successes of the George W. Bush administration was passing the No Child Left Behind Act. It was a bipartisan legislative initiative that brought accountability into school systems using testing and the elimination of so-called failing schools. Well, the president, Barack Obama, in his State of the Union address, his first State of the Union address, early in his administration, announced these possible strategic changes in No Child Left Behind.
Instead of rewarding failure, we only reward success. Instead of funding the status quo, we only invest in reform. Reform that raises student achievement, inspires students to excel in math and science, and turns around failing schools that steal the future of too many young Americans, from rural communities to the inner city. In the 21st century, the best anti-poverty program around is a world-class education.
Well, what do those passionately talked about ideas from the president mean in the schoolhouse? Joining us now is Dan Domenech, who's executive director of the American Association of School Administrators. He joins us from Virginia. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
And Dr. Virginia Minshew is a principal at Parkview High School in Sterling, Virginia. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, you know, let's talk a little bit about what seems to be a shift in emphasis. No Child Left Behind was all about accountability and the elimination of so-called failed schools. It seems like the president wants to substitute more of a reward-based system. How do you see that, Dan Domenech?
Well, we are very excited about that change because, frankly, there were good things and bad things about No Child Left Behind. But one of the things that I really rankled educators and many parents was the very punitive elements of No Child Left Behind, where by virtue of the way that they computed things like adequate yearly progress, there were many sound, good-performing schools around the country that were labeled as failures, and many students that were labeled as failing, when really a reward, a more positive aspect to the program, as the president now suggests, I think would have done more to further the cause of closing that achievement gap.
Now, again, we don't know the specifics, but is it your understanding that the federal government would then assist schools that are having trouble measuring up to turn them around, as the president suggested in his speech?
Absolutely. We've had the opportunity to meet on a regular basis with Secretary of Education Duncan and his staff, and they're definitely focusing on what they've identified as the lowest 5%. Including about 2,000 high schools around the country that are referred to as dropout factories. And they're going to be putting a great deal of focus and attention on those schools and providing the kind of financial support that they will need, hopefully, to transform themselves.
So, Virginia Minshew, what does that mean for your students, and when can you expect maybe the cavalry to arrive there from the federal government?
Well, I agree with what Dr. Domenech said in terms of this rewards success for and positive things going on in school. I like the concept that this is rewarding growth in schools and in classrooms. There are many of us who work in school-based programs who see our teachers and our kids working extremely hard and making progress, but because on that one test day, they didn't do well on the test, all of their efforts are really devalued. And I think that what has been proposed certainly looks at a wider breadth of experiences for students and for teachers, because we do want to be held accountable.
Dr. Minshew, is there a value to continuity here? It took many years for schools to gear up to actually implement a No Child Left Behind. Is a full-scale change going to be disruptive to the classroom there in Sterling, Virginia?
You know, when I read the brief information that I have read, it's really not a total full-scale change. It's really a tweaking of some of the things that we feel as educators need to be changed. That focus on that one-time test, looking, and I can use my school as an example. We are a school who has really grown in the last 3 years, but yet this last year, I am classified as a school that did not make AYP because in two subgroups, my pass rate was 78% rather than 79%.
So it's a different way of using the data, staying with the test, more of a tweak, but something that accounts for the changing situation in your community. Dan Domenech, we've already heard about the president's program called Race to the Top, which attempts to identify best practices and reward them with cash. Do you think that figures into this program at all?
Well, I think it does. I think what we've seen the administration doing is kind of signaling their intent for the reauthorization of what we refer to now as No Child Left Behind. We saw that with the stimulus dollars that went out. We're seeing it now with the guidelines for Race to the Top. We're seeing it in the guidelines for the innovation funds that are going to become available this spring. So there's no question that the administration has been telegraphing the direction they want to take, and it very much is the carrot, more of the carrot than the stick approach.
Right.
that they're dangling dollars at a time when schools desperately need every cent they can get. I mean, you can just read here in the Washington, D.C. area, Montgomery County, Fairfax County, all the districts that are really cutting their budgets to pieces because of the lack of funding. So school systems and states are hungry for dollars, and they are jumping through hoops to qualify to get these dollars.
Because the federal government is offering it, and that means more federal influence in education. I mean, if you count No Child Left Behind, plus all these new initiatives from the Obama administration, the federal government stepping into education. Dr. Virginia Minshew, principal at Parkview High School in Sterling, Virginia. Dan Domenech, executive director of the American Association of School Administrators. That's how the Obama education initiatives look at the schoolhouse level. Coming up, if you know someone who's unemployed, what's the best way to help them out? Look over their resume, give them money. The conversation is later this hour. Sometimes it's awkward, but what's your story? Tell us your story at 877-8MYTAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. What's the responsibility to your unemployed friends and unemployed folks? What hurts and what helps? This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. First off, a warning. There are some spoilers for some great shows ahead.
Great shows.
Tonight marks the beginning of the end of an, oh my God, so totally confusing but still strangely compelling journey. For those who've stuck with the show for the last 5 years, it's the last season of Lost.
This is what you've been wasting your time on?
Dudes, listen. Our lives suck. Everyone's nerves are stretched to the max. I mean, we're lost on an island, running from boars and monsters, freaking polar bears.
Polar bears?
You didn't hear about the polar bear?
A few years ago, it was announced that Lost would have this definite end date, and one of our staffers said, yay!
Many of our staff said yay.
It's true, because look at it this way. Good TV is best enjoyed like a lovely dinner, just enough to leave you wanting more, not an all-you-can-eat buffet.
There are a lot of shows that could learn from having an expiration date. There's an actual word for this. TV executives, you actually came up with it on Happy Days. Remember the Jump the Shark episode?
We both make one jump. There's only one condition. We jump an obstacle.
Well, let's make it something big. You know, like your head.
Good one. Oh, it's big all right. It's the shark.
So Happy Days jumped the shark, but let's take case one, The Office. The American Office continues on and on with its sixth season. But, you know, I think they can learn a lesson from the predecessor show, Over the Pond, The British Office.
The people you work with are people you were just thrown together with, and yet you spend more time with them than you do your friends or your family. And so when someone comes in who you have a connection with, and Dawn was a ray of sunshine in my life, but if I'm really being honest, I never really thought it would have a happy ending.
Of course, the guy does get the girl, but do you know how quickly it took the show to get from beginning to end? Just 13 episodes.
13?
That's it.
Isn't that kind of an unlucky
13 person? Classics. Instant classics. That's the way the Brits do things. Short and sweet.
You know,
I like that.
You got to know when to quit while you're ahead. There's some shows that had the chance to end early and wrap things up, but they kept going. Case number two, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. That show was on for 7 years, but get this. At the end of its fifth year, the network was dropping, and that was good timing because the show had planned a big finale. Buffy saved her sister's life by sacrificing her own.
Dawn, listen to me. Listen. I love you. I will always love you. This is the work that I have to do.
Doesn't that sound like the end of a really good, strong ending? That's where the series was supposed to stop. No Buffy, no Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But then what happens? The show got picked up by another network. They had to resurrect Buffy.
Well, it is about vampires. I mean, they can do anything they want.
Well, yeah, but, you know, according to our producer, Leo, the quality of the show just went straight down the tubes.
Poor, poor Buffy. But there are some shows that can be a model of knowing when to end it, although we had a little debate around The Office here. Ones that stay on the air for just long enough, like The Wire.
When you walk through the garden.
The creators set the show up like a Greek tragedy or a Shakespeare play with a story arc that only spanned 5 seasons. That way, when the last few episodes aired, there were no loose ends to tie up.
Either we fix this police department and the crime goes down, or we don't, and the crime stays up.
Commissioner, we're talking about a little help. In the next couple quarters, that's all.
No.
What the?
Tell the mayor his debts will be clean.
Five seasons, five acts. You can't improve on Shakespeare. So TV executives, I know it's hard to let go of the cash cows, but you can't risk the quality. I mean, 24, that show's got to go. American Idol, get rid of it. It's done. Over.
Expiration dates, they're great for milk. Why can't you use them for TV shows, please? And listeners, if you have a show that you think needs to go, that has reached its expiration date, let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry, and coming up in a moment, we're going to discuss a topic which is sometimes awkward. If you're unemployed, how do you ask for help, and what kind of help do you need? Or if you have friends or family who are unemployed, what do you give to them? What is it okay to offer in terms of help? Let us know your stories at 8778-MY-TAKE. First, though, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. And Oscar nominations are just out. Joining us now is Rafer Guzman, Takeaway movie contributor and film critic for Newsday. Well, there have been predictions for a while, Rafer. Who got the nomination, those 10 nomination spots for Best Picture?
The Best Picture nominations were, I feel like Anne Hathaway making the announcement this morning. It was Avatar, The Blind Side, which was a surprise, District 9, and Education. The Hurt Locker, which was no surprise. I think that was a big frontrunner in many people's minds for a long time. Inglourious Bastards and Precious. Serious Man, Up in the Air. And then I think the big news was Up, the animated film, which got nominated both for Best Picture and for Best Animated Feature, which I'm pretty sure is the first time it's ever happened.
And Best Screenplay.
Right.
And Best Screenplay, right.
Which really does not often happen at all for animated films.
That's right. It's been a really good year for animated films. I think it was interesting that they saved that feature, actually, for the second to last in the announcement run-up. So I think that kind of shows how I think people are pretty interested in that category this time around.
Any other surprises among the nominations?
Well, I mean, I guess you could say that Sandra Bullock was a bit of a surprise for leading actress. You know, she was in this surprise hit, The Blind Side, the sports drama. That, I mean, that's not a surprise if you were watching the Golden Globes because she was nominated for that. But I think it's a little bit of a surprise just in general, since most people think of her as kind of a lightweight comedic actress. So that's quite a coup for her.
What did you think about these 10 nominations? Did it make room for films that deserve to be in? I mean, we would have seen Up in there if we didn't have 10 nomination slots.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way to really quantify this, but I think the films that may have snuck into the bottom five, so to speak, the ones that may not have been there, had this just been a normal Oscar year, would probably be The Blind Side, District 9, which was a big popcorn sci-fi film, An Education, which was a smaller indie drama, Serious Man, which the Coen Brothers film, which, you know, got pretty good reviews, but was not a huge critical success. It wasn't a huge box office hit. And then, of course, Up. I'm not sure if Up would have gotten a nomination like this had we just had, you know, five nominees.
Okay, we're going to be talking about this more. That's Rafer Guzman, Takeaway movie contributor and film critic for Newsday.
So in Haiti, the 10 Americans arrested while trying to take children out of the country without proper documents may be headed for trial, we learned this morning. The Haitian prime minister says the Americans knew they were breaking the law, and some of the children have surviving parents, but no charges have been filed yet. A postage-sized piece of metal is the fix for those vehicles affected in Toyota's worldwide recall. Toyota Vice President Robert Waltz says it's not a temporary repair.
It's a long-term fix. It is not an interim solution to a problem.
Toyota says the fix will take less than an hour. Finally, Punxsutawney Phil has emerged to see his shadow in Pennsylvania. You know what that means. Winter will last another 6 weeks. Happy February 2nd, folks. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
We talk about work on The Takeaway on Tuesdays, and today we're talking about how to help people who are unemployed. Here's the statistical fact. There are so many people in the United States who are unemployed that even if you yourself are not unemployed, it's extremely likely that somebody close to you is. And the question today is, how do you help? Or if you're unemployed, what help do you need? Joining us to talk about this is Justin Jones-Fosu, a leadership trainer and host of WEAA Baltimore's Listen Up. He's got some advice on this subject. And also Elena Guevara is a technical fashion designer, been out of work for the past 10 months, Elena?
Yes.
Okay, and she's going to talk about what friends have been trying to do to help her. So most of the past 9 or 10 months, you've been unemployed. That's a long time.
Yes, it is a long time.
And I assume that your friends want to help you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is okay and what's not okay? I have friends that I would like to help. What can I do for them? Is it just resume service? Can I offer to pay to copy or mail their resume? Can I offer them money?
Friends get weird about money, so I don't know if that is specifically the right way to go, unless it's specifically asked for. But in the beginning when I was actively looking for work, I did have friends print out copies of my resume for me at their jobs because I don't have access to a printer at home. And that was very helpful. That was useful. I've also had the dinner invitations and, friends took me out for drinks and took me out for dinner. And, that's always very nice.
Okay. So were they helpful?
Yeah, I would say those things are helpful. I mean, the last thing you want to do is become isolated when you're unemployed. And, you're already spending all day at home by yourself anyway. So if you see your friends less often because you can't afford to go out, that just adds to that feeling of isolation.
Okay, Justin, we have 10% of Americans unemployed. Everybody knows that somebody that's out of work. How can we help someone that we know that is unemployed?
A very good question. I think, first of all, being available and listening is so important. We really can't underestimate that. Almost half of unemployed people surveyed by the New York Times in December said they suffered from depression or anxiety, and having someone to talk to can really help. But it's also really appreciated when you try to help them get connected to some job opportunities. Talk them up, even when they're not around, to some of your business contacts, the networking events, and, just some of the places outside of your fields of work. The more people you know, the larger potential of them hearing about job leads.
Okay, but some of my good friends, I can think of a couple of them right now. I'm either not sure what they're like on the job, or I happen to know one who is chronic absences. I mean, am I taking a risk by talking somebody up that I'm not sure of their job performance?
You make a really good point, Celeste. One thing we can't do is jeopardize our own reputation and credibility for the sake of your friends. Only recommend people that you have a lot of confidence in, and you can connect those to your main contacts. For the rest of some of your unemployed friends, offer to help sell themselves, connect them to some networking sites, whether LinkedIn or Facebook, because it's interesting that more than two-thirds consider their changing their career field, and you can help brainstorm with them to help them find, a potential job.
Maybe get with a little imagination. So, Elena Guevara, have you had offers of help that was, you talked about people taking you out to dinner or copying your resume for you. What if people offered that was not so helpful?
More general job search ideas, like suggestions like, have you tried Craigslist or have you networked with your friends? Very general things like that. Either they don't apply to me or I've already tried them. Yeah.
Have
you thought about getting a job?
Yeah.
At all?
I have a friend who keeps pushing me into waitressing work, and I'm like, I have never waitressed in my life. Why do you think that I would be qualified to waitress until I find a regular job? I just assume that, a restaurant is going to hire people with experience rather than someone who just happens to be an unemployed fashion designer who needs to waitress.
But there's an awkwardness around this. One of my friends wanted to go to a training session that would help her in her job search. She said, I'm not sure if I can afford the plane ticket. I said, let me buy the plane ticket for you. Is that okay? Is that if somebody offered that to you, is that an okay thing to offer?
Yeah, I think that would be an okay thing to offer. Absolutely.
Do you feel awkward sometimes? Have there been offers of help that you felt strange about accepting?
On a small level, yes. I don't want to have my friends take me out to dinner all the time. So after a while, I kind of stopped accepting invitations out.
You should hit her up for a plane ticket, I think that'd be a good idea.
Well, Justin, what about this awkward? She's saying that after a while, she stops accepting it, but at the same time, she doesn't want to be isolated.
Absolutely. One of the things we should definitely do is consider giving them money, but not as a charity for work that they do. One great couple of websites that you can use is, if you decide to give them money, is give them anonymously. There's an organization that's called givinganon.org or myregistry.com, which you can leave money for them as an anonymous tip.
Well, are there other things? Are there things that people should not do, that people should steer away from offering?
Absolutely. I think that you have to be very careful in communicating yourself like you're giving them charity. So you have to take a step back and realize, what kind of friend is this? How would they respond to this? And if you can give them money as a gift or ask them to pay it forward, but don't make them feel pressured that they have to pay it back.
Okay, Justin Jones-Fosu is a leadership trainer, host of WEAA Baltimore's Listen Up. Elena Guevara, unemployed technical fashion designer who, you should accept those free dinners. And maybe someone out there needs an unemployed technical fashion designer. Good luck. If you're unemployed right now, what's the one thing you want your friends to do? Or if you know someone who's unemployed, how do you help them?
Philomena from Westchester. Instead of sending a gift to a nephew who was unemployed for the holidays, I send Omaha Steak. Well, they had chicken, but Omaha Steak is the company. And that was my gift instead of a thing they could put on the shelf.
That's a pretty delicious gift. Let us know your story at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org.
We need your help on thetakeaway.org. Find out if your congressman or senator is going to the Super Bowl and figure out how they got their tickets. Post it to our website. We're working with ProPublica to try to figure out how these lawmakers get to go to the Super Bowl. We'll post the results on our website, thetakeaway.org. And, of course, good week, bad week. We take a look at it every Friday. Our friends from The Week magazine, we need your nominations, though. Who's having a good week or a bad week? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Have a good week. It's only Tuesday. This is The Takeaway.
Then put your little hand in mine.
Here we go again.
Folks, Attorney Phil.
That's right, woodchuck chuckers. It's Groundhog Day. Get up and check.
On Groundhog Day, we ask the really big questions.
If you only had one day to live, I mean, the whole world is about to explode. What do you do?
Groundhogs. A creature becomes a holiday, becomes a movie, becomes a religious text. Bill Murray as an apostle of redemption?
Am I right or am I right? Or am I right? Am I right?
I kid you not. Stay tuned on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, February 2nd. Happy Groundhog's Day. And The Takeaway this morning is going to be a religious discussion of the religious significance of the movie Groundhog Day later on this hour.
Because of the weather predictions?
No, it is an amazing story. It's an amazing conversation. Stay tuned.
Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. Medical evacuation flights for injured Haitians are now in the air again after U.S. officials decided to fly the wounded to several states so that Florida will not be overwhelmed. They'd been suspended since last week, those flights, when Florida Governor Charlie Crist said the state's hospitals were reaching the saturation point.
Florida never said that we wanted to stop taking Haitians. All we said was that we would appreciate help in being able to continue to help our friends from the island. And that's exactly what has happened.
Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Dr. Mark McKinney, chief of surgery at the University of Miami Hospital. He told us local medical teams in Haiti need to take charge.
The Haitians are starting to identify us as the caregivers and are starting to send over more patients. The exit strategy is not clear. We're on the ground right now, but we need to help set up Haitians who can take care of the Haitian people.
The American Red Cross says a waiting list for aid deliveries into Haiti is over 1,000 flights long.
Wow. Haiti's prime minister says those 10 Americans arrested while trying to take children out of the country without proper documents should be put on trial for child trafficking. He says the religious group knew it was breaking the law since some of the children have surviving parents. For a quick update on this story, George Prentice joins us now. He's a reporter and host for Boise State Radio, where the church in question is based. George, a church with a busload of kids and some questionable paperwork there in Haiti. Is this a case of bureaucracy down there or over-exuberant missionaries who believe they are doing God's work?
Well, the answers, I guess, would be yes and yes if you ask two different people. There's very little middle ground. Some say God wanted them to go to Haiti, and others are saying it's incredibly wrong-headed and no wonder the world hates us.
Another religious story. We're going to get to the bottom of it in just a moment. George Prentice, stay with us.
Now for the latest on that massive Toyota recall. Toyota President Jim Lentz says a small steel shim about the size of a postage stamp is all that's needed to permanently fix the problem with accelerators.
The parts will be arriving in dealerships. If not late on Tuesday, they will begin arriving on Wednesday. All of the training should be completed by the end of the week, so they will start working on consumer vehicles this weekend.
Toyota says the repairs will take about a half an hour.
Oscar nominations have just come out. They're too numerous to name, but we'll give you a few. We'll give you some highlights. We're going to talk about it later on in the program. Best Picture, Avatar, Up in the Air, The Hurt Locker, Morgan Freeman and George Clooney up for Best Actor. Sandra Bullock made the cut for Best Actress. Meryl Streep got a nomination. Big surprise. For Best Director, James Cameron, his wife Catherine, ex-wife Catherine Bigelow, and Quentin Tarantino were all nominated. And it's Groundhog Day. not terribly good news. Punxsutawney Phil, Americans' favorite rodent, saw his shadow in Pennsylvania, meaning we're in for another 6 weeks of winter. Didn't move the markets, though. Asian and European markets are up, so are futures. The Dow gets underway at 10,185. The S&P opens at 1,089. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,171. We're going to talk more about that favorite film of so many religious scholars and faith leaders.
If you only had one day to live, what would you do with it?
The World According to Groundhog Day. Yes, the movie with Bill Murray. We're not kidding. The conversation is coming up later in the hour.
I think Disney would argue that Punxsutawney Phil is not the country's favorite rodent. But we're also talking about the unemployment unemployed today. How do you help your friends who are unemployed? What's the most useful thing you can do? Or if you're unemployed, what's the best thing you would ask from your friends? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
With all of the headlines coming out of Haiti since the devastating earthquake 3 weeks ago, this has become an international incident. The question of what the Central Valley Baptist Church workers were doing with a busload of Haitian kids at the border of the Dominican Republic without proper documentation. The church members have been detained. There are now questions about what they were actually trying to do with the kids. Here's Clint Henry, the pastor of the Central Valley Baptist Church, speaking yesterday.
We were not trying to traffic children. We were simply trying to minister to a desperate situation there in that country, and we had a facility that could be used to do that temporarily.
Haitian authorities, on the other hand, say the group didn't have proper documentation for the children, and they say some of the children weren't even orphans. The group, based in Idaho, says, as you heard there, they were only trying to help. Getting to the bottom of this is difficult, and we're rejoined by George Prentice, a reporter and host for Boise State Radio in Idaho, who laid out there at the top of the hour just how difficult it is to get clarity here. You're feeling that as well as a reporter, right, George?
You bet. Definitely both sides of the issue, but very little middle ground.
All right. Michelle Montaz is a former U.N. spokeswoman for the Secretary General in New York, a former director of Radio Haiti, and she's a Haitian journalist. Good morning to you, Michelle.
Good morning, John.
Let's talk about, first of all, how this is being reported down in Haiti.
Well, you know, I think it is being reported for what it is. I mean, those, you know, no matter what their intentions were, those were people trying to take children out at a time when, you know, there are a number of cases of children being trafficked out of Haiti. There are a number of reports that were alarming. And there are the reason why it was done is because they didn't have proper documentation. I also know of a number of orphans who have left with proper documentation. They were, their papers were signed by the Prime Minister himself so they could go. So some have left on a regular basis, on a legal basis.
Indeed. And since the earthquake, the Prime Minister has to sign for every child who leaves the country. George Prentice, what is the reputation of the Central Valley Baptist Church? And would you expect them to be involved in something like this, you know, that's not above board?
Well, the church is a member of the Southern Baptist Convention, and that's the country's largest Protestant denomination. They're also known for humanitarian programs. But this particular initiative was a nonprofit. A couple of ladies started it called the New Life Children's Refuge, and they just started it last fall. So this is pretty loosey-goosey right now.
Now, when you say loosey-goosey, it means it's not accredited, it's not clear what the mission is, or these are people who are so imbued with the sense of doing God's work that maybe they're inclined to break the rules?
Certainly, while they are accredited, there is no defined mission, and one of the members who is actually being detained in Haiti right now says God wanted us to come here to help children.
Well, that can't be helpful to shorten their detention, I would imagine, at this point. Michelle Montaz, what is the interest of the Haitian government in trying to keep the impression from getting out that basically Haiti's children aren't safe in Haiti and that they need to be sent outside of the country?
Well, no one has nothing to do with the government. No one is safe in Haiti. We had a tremendous event that occurred on January 12th. We had an earthquake. And we have aftershocks, and there are credible information that there might be more and more severe ones. So everyone is at risk in Haiti. However, you know, some children who lost their parents the day after the earthquake or the day of the earthquake, you know, some of the parents have been trying to trace their children and they have found them, okay? And everything is being done to help parents trace their children and find them. Okay, so to me, the fact that there is the impression that, you know, Haiti needs help, Haiti needs help. However, it's not a reason to go beyond the law. It has nothing to do with the government. It has to do with the law of the country.
Michelle Montaz, a former UN spokeswoman for the Secretary General in New York and a Haitian journalist speaking to us from Port-au-Prince. You know, is it possible that this organization will get the chance to make their paperwork right? Or do you think that organizations are coming to Haiti and taking advantage of the situation?
I think some have been very, very helpful. And all the children who had their paperwork already in the pipeline, they were all given the possibility to go and join their adoptive families in the States or elsewhere. So there is a process which was ongoing. Right now, it's a bit difficult to initiate new processes because, most of the judicial system, at least in Port-au-Prince, collapsed. However, there is a judge that heard these missionaries, and the process is ongoing. Whether they can be tried in Haiti or in the States, it's something that has not been determined yet. For the time being, they were breaking Haitian law.
Right. Well, let's listen to here's a George Willett, who you may have seen on some of the cable programs, who's been speaking publicly. He's from the SOS orphanage in Haiti. And the Associated Press interviewed him talking about some of the children who were obtained from the custody of the Central Valley Baptist Church. And he describes, first of all, their situation. Listen to this.
I'm not an orphan. I do have my parents. I thought I'm going to a boarding school or to a summer camp. We don't know it exactly, to the Dominican Republic. Babies which were dehydrated, we have had the Red Cross here. And one of these little babies, it might be 2 or 3 months old, we had to bring it immediately to the hospital.
George Prentice, do you have any sense there in Boise if this church has attempted to intercede to U.S. authorities to try to get themselves released?
Well, I can tell you that the Idaho congressional delegation, our two senators and two House members, came out with what could easily be considered a carefully crafted statement saying that they were in touch with the State Department, et cetera, to represent the interests, if you will, of the Central Valley Baptist Church.
So, George, you're all over this story. What do you want people around the country to know about the relationship between this group and your community?
Other Northwest adoption agencies are really concerned about the shadow this is casting on them. They're saying the last thing that anyone would want is for a child to come here and then find out that the father or mother is actually alive.
All right. George Prentice, reporter and host for Boise State Radio, which is where Central Valley Baptist Church is located. The individuals from that church are being detained. Michelle Montaz, thanks so much for being with us.
You're most welcome, John.
Michelle is former UN spokeswoman for the Secretary General in New York, and she's working in Haiti trying to sort out the situation there as a Haitian journalist and also spokesperson for the government. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the top stories we're following.
President Obama will try to sell his economic agenda and re-energize voters when he travels to New Hampshire today. While he's there, he'll tour a local business and hold his second town hall in 6 days. The president is also urging Congress to approve his $3.8 trillion budget. That raises the deficit to a record $1.6 trillion. But the president says right now he needs to focus on stimulating the economy, not reducing the deficit. We've been talking about Haiti all morning. Now the U.S. military will begin flying injured survivors to several U.S. hospitals. That's after Florida's governor said his state's hospitals were being overloaded. Yesterday, the federal government announced it will reimburse American hospitals treating earthquake victims. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Dr. Aneta Roldan, president of Jackson Health System in Miami. She says some aspects of the reimbursement are unclear.
Well, we don't know if this is going to be retroactive. Know that this is as of yesterday, so it is moving forward.
Meanwhile, in Haiti, hundreds of people have organized the first political demonstration since the disaster. They want Haitian President Reynald Préval to resign.
Certainly people in South Florida paying attention to that story, and we welcome our new South Florida listeners on WLRN this week. Toyota will use a small steel shim to repair vehicles affected by the massive recall. The repair will take about a half hour per car. The problem is costing the automaker about $155 million a week in lost sales. The groundhog saw his shadow, another 6 weeks of winter. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, the movie Groundhog Day. It's a religious text.
Hey, you want that to go?
I'll take three news takeouts, and two of them are right here in the studio. Louise Story, business and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is also here with a sports takeout a little bit later in the segment. Good morning.
Good morning.
Louise, let's begin with you. The Inspector General, a guy by the name of Neil Barofsky. I'm sure he's a fine, fine fellow, but these Inspector Generals are sort of paid to be very, very critical. Had a controversial thing to say about the TARP program. He is actually the person who's responsible for oversight of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, along with some others. But Neil Barofsky described the TARP as having saved our financial system from driving off a cliff back in 2008. But absent meaningful reform, we are still, the U.S. economy, driving on the same winding mountain road, but this time in a faster car. It sounds like he's warning that we're in worse shape, maybe, than we were a year ago.
He is, John. What he's saying is that, you know, this too-big-to-fail thing we've set up where everyone assumes now that if a bank gets in trouble, the government will bail it out, actually has the moral hazard of perhaps encouraging banks to take more risk because they know that they'll be saved. This guy, Neil Barofsky, is really interesting. He's kind of like the Kenneth Starr, you know, from the Clinton administration.
Right, sure.
He's a former U.S. attorney, and you know what he used to do was fight Colombian drug lords.
Oh, so he's
an interesting,
pull punches.
Tough person. Yeah. In fact, he apparently keeps the knife from someone who tried to kill him down in Colombia over his former work. So these banks, you know, should be a little afraid of him. But he has really taken some tough positions. He's accused the former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson of misleading the public about how bad the situation was in 08. He's been the only one who's required the banks under oath to tell us exactly how they spent those bailout funds. And so now for him to take this position that really nothing has changed, the government has not put anything meaningful in place to rein these banks in, either with pay or with financial reform, and he says that's very dangerous.
Well, demoralizing, and we will see if anything happens as a result of this Inspector General report. Louise Story, business and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks.
Our next takeout comes to us from the laboratories of the University of Michigan. We have with us Sean Morrison. He's the director of the school's Center for Stem Cell Biology. And they think they've identified a frightening trend in research that could lead to some major breakthroughs in Parkinson's, cancer, or multiple sclerosis treatments. Joining us is Sean Morrison. So, Sean, what is it you found as you looked through the current stem cell research?
Well, under the Bush administration policy, very few stem cell lines were available for research. And of those, nobody really knew which human populations they were derived from. So we tested the most commonly used lines genetically and found that the vast majority of the lines were of European origin. A few were from the Middle East, probably from Israeli populations, and a few were from Asia. But they did not represent the diversity in our society, and there were certain populations that were notably underrepresented, like anybody of African descent.
Why does it matter? Does there make a difference between one cell and another?
Well, a fundamental principle of medical research is that we test new therapies on diverse patients because we never know when therapies could affect patients from different human populations differently. And so if embryonic stem cell research has the potential to change the future of medicine, we should be able to study diverse lines to make sure that the therapies that are developed have the intended effects in diverse backgrounds.
Do you know why we don't have diverse stem cells, and does that help you know how to fix it?
Well, in the first instance, we just needed to derive lines to be able to do the research, and we had very few available. Now, under the new National Institutes of Health policy, many new lines will be available to federally funded researchers, and now's the time when we can start considering issues like ensuring appropriate diversity exists out there. And for I think one of the steps that will be necessary would be to derive new lines for underrepresented groups, such as from people of African descent, to make sure that they're adequately represented in the research, and that's something we'd like to do at the University of Michigan.
That's interesting. Thanks so much. Sean Morrison is the director of the University of Michigan's Center for Stem Cell Biology.
Well, he's counting the hours here in the studio. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Super Bowl is on Sunday, right?
Yes,
exciting. And every day leading up to the Super Bowl, we're going to profile interesting players who have great stories to tell. We also have a basketball milestone in a moment. But first, the Saints, Jahari Evans, is that how you pronounce
Jahari his name? Evans.
Jahari Evans. What's the story with him?
So he's an offensive lineman, which is he protects the quarterback.
Got
and
it.
He plays for the New Orleans Saints. In 2006, he came to the New Orleans Saints, which was a band of misfits. And he had previously been at Bloomsburg in Pennsylvania, which is a small Division II school, which is not quite the place that you normally get an NFL prospect. In high school, he had badly fractured his leg. Nobody was looking at him. So he ended up at this Division II school. He excels at this Division II school. And then somehow scouts came around him and picked him up, and they pulled him up. And the Saints took a chance on him. As a rookie, because of injuries to the veterans, he immediately was thrust into the starting position. And now he's on a team of destiny.
And he's an all-pro.
He's an all-pro.
So he goes from fractured knee at a bad school to essentially a walk-on with the Saints, the misfit Saints, and now he's an all-pro on his way to the Super Bowl.
And when he was in high school, he was a top 10 in his class. He had well over 1,000 in the SATs. So he's also a very likable guy. He really took to Bloomsburg. He goes back every year. He does a camp for offensive linemen. And at the beginning of the season, we talked about the importance of offensive linemen. And with a guy like quarterback Drew Brees behind you, you have to have a solid offensive line, and he's the anchor of that
he's
line.
He's the protector. Can you book him on the show? Sounds like a great guy.
He does let's sound like him. A great guy.
Give him let's a call. Him. All right, get started on that. But let's talk about this milestone. Kobe Bryant becomes the Lakers' all-time points leader with 44 points last night.
He has more points than George Mikan, Jerry West, Elgin Baylor, Magic Johnson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Wilt Chamberlain. And for the NBA franchise that's arguably one of the most dominant franchises sports history,
sure,
the Los Angeles Lakers, now Kobe Bryant is the leading scorer out of that group, and that's an astounding achievement.
That is so huge. Is that because of his longevity? Is that because of his per-game average? What?
I think it's also because he started before all of them. He came straight out of high school. So let's not forget that.
Okay, so he had that advantage.
Exactly.
But it's still an enormous milestone. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much. Those are your takeouts. Coming up, we've been talking about how to rebuild Haiti. Today we talk about rebuilding housing. More in just a few minutes.
Coming up, the problem in Haiti, do you build something quickly that gets people shelter right away, or do you build something that can withstand the hurricanes that are coming and the years ahead? We're going to talk about that in a few moments. Also, all day today, we're thinking about how to help the unemployed. When one of them is your friend or your family member, how do you help them? What kind of assistance do you offer? Or if you are unemployed, what do you need?
This is Brian from KPAC, and we helped out my cousin and his family. I went up to the school, and I paid for his son for the whole lunch for the whole year, and I did it for his daughter, too.
Wow, that's a really great offer of help. Let us know your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it on our site, thetakeaway.org. Here's some of the news stories that we're following at 31 minutes after the hour. President Obama's budget may face an early test this week on Capitol Hill. His proposed tax credit for small businesses could come up for a vote in the Senate by Friday. Today, White House Budget Director Peter Orszag will appear before Congress to explain the ballooning deficit.
We don't want to act too rapidly to bring down the deficit because that would exacerbate the jobs deficit.
Also this morning, the president heads to New Hampshire to promote his idea to send $30 billion to community banks so they can help small businesses.
U.S. military now says it will fly injured Haitian earthquake survivors to several states to avoid overloading Florida. Florida Governor Charlie Crist describes the cost incurred by his state.
After about 3 days, it was about 1.7 million. After about a week, it was 7.1 million. And we're probably at approximately $10 million to date.
Federal government says it will reimburse hospitals who treat earthquake victims from Haiti. Meanwhile, Haitian officials are considering a trial for those 10 Americans arrested while trying to take children out of the country without proper documents. The Haitian prime minister says the Americans knew they were breaking the law and that some of the children have surviving parents. Here at home, the Academy Award nominations are out. Avatar and Hurt Locker lead with 9 nominations each. Best Picture and Director for James Cameron of Avatar. Other nominees include Sandra Bullock for The Blind Side, Jeff Bridges for Crazy Heart, Monique for Precious, and Matt Damon for Invictus. In a shocking development, Meryl Streep was nominated again, 16th time for her, adding to her record that just doesn't stop. Markets are open. Dow is up about 11 points. The S&P up about a point and a half, and same for the NASDAQ after futures were marginally up all morning long. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Yesterday on the show, we started a conversation about how Haiti can transform itself and transition from rescue efforts into long-term rebuilding. We spoke to economist Paul Collier about that process, and we asked him what the triggers are for long-term economic sustainability.
First, let's look for sustainable housing. So not tents, but simple one-room buildings that can then be expanded down the line. Let's look for those houses to be located in places where economic opportunity can be built.
Okay, how do you actually make that happen? We have somebody here with the answers to that question. Andreas Duwani is an architect from Miami. He was involved in the reconstruction after Katrina, and he just returned from Haiti 2 days ago. Good morning, Andreas.
Hello, good morning.
So do you agree with what you just heard from economist Paul Collier, that you need to find simple, sustainable building solutions so that that eventually leads to long-term recovery?
You know, I think so. I think actually just about every idea for the time being is a good one. But in the end, the one sustainable thing, given the very large numbers and problems, the scale of the problems, is to harness the energy of the people, you know, the people themselves and their smarts. You know, I think the Haitians, from what I could tell, were clever, self-organizing people that, given the chance, will dig themselves out.
Okay, but this is an urgent issue at the moment because you have two warring problems. You have, number one, an issue of urgency that people need shelter now. Hurricane season is coming. Rains are coming. Mm-hmm. And the other is that you have to build something, some kind of structures for them that can actually survive hurricane season.
Well, there are lots of structures. And I was studying aerial photography yesterday, you know, from Google. You should know that Google Earth has actually photographed Port-au-Prince after the hurricane. After the earthquake.
Wow.
You know, they have very recent photographs. And what's astonishing is the pattern of masonry buildings haven't fallen. You know, what most people visit is the downtown with masonry buildings. But then you look at the shanty towns on the hillside, which are built out of more resilient materials, you know, metal and wood. And what you find is huge areas that are intact. And these are the kinds of structures that people from the outside never consider. You know, they always consider, let's have the permanent solid structures. And, you know, while there's a huge areas of shanty towns that have not yet been visited, you know, I've asked people and said, no, we haven't penetrated that area. We don't know what's happening there. But the aerial photography shows that entire areas have survived. And these are the hand-built structures of the people themselves.
So rather than bringing in tents, should we be investing in structures that can be put up very quickly and easily and, I assume, inexpensively, that perhaps can survive the elements?
Well, no, I don't think there's a rather. I think we need to build in tents. We need to bring in tents, and we need to bring in prefabricated buildings of all technologies. But when you think about that, the largest you know, proposals are maybe 500 units, you know, 1,000 units, and there could easily be 100,000 and 200,000 people in need of housing, I think that the answer is everything must be done, but not least let people build for themselves the way they're used to. Even if to our eyes it looks incredibly impoverished, you know, and incredibly sad, you know, those little shanty town structures are really survived.
No, and they have experience. They have experience in precisely those conditions. I guess, you know, we've talked with people from Architecture for Humanity on this program, and they talk a good game about what's needed in Haiti. I'm wondering if there's a way to create what Paul Collier talked about yesterday, this sort of staircase of architecture, where you begin with a tent, but then the tent becomes part of maybe a building that becomes more of a traditional shanty dwelling. That so you can actually accumulate a dwelling rather than having to constantly throw things away.
Well, I think so. I'm not sure the tents can grow, but I do think that, for example, a pile of, you know, bulk deliveries of 2x4s, you know, and piles of corrugated iron, which is what they make the roofs and walls out of, corrugated steel, and maybe, you know, wire to slash things together, just delivering piles of these things would actually yield to a lot of energy being applied, you know, by people themselves. Now, there is one caveat, which is these are very poor people, and they're, you know, it's more likely than not that they'll just sell the stuff, you know, that will become into a kind of form of very minor graft. So we have two contradictory things here. We have the people's ability to do for themselves, but also the need to make sure that they land in the right things.
Now, how is this different than the experience that you had in rebuilding Katrina? Are you seeing some of the same issues?
Well, no, Katrina, you know, the little houses, the so-called Katrina cottages, of which 3,000, for example, were delivered in Mississippi, those are palaces by Haiti standards, you know. The very wealthiest people live in what in Mississippi is a temporary Katrina cottage. So, you know, I've designed already four types of housing for, you know, almost one a day. And what I have to do is recalibrate downwards. You know, I designed something that seems very simple and very, you know, and then I realize that these people are even poorer than that. This morning I read about a woman in the New York Times that built, that had an 8-foot by 8-foot shelter built for four people for $60.
Wow.
You know, and even after 4 days, I have not calibrated downwards to that.
But could it withstand a hurricane? That's the question. Andreas Duany, architect and planner from Miami, he was involved in the reconstruction after Katrina.
It's Ecumenical Day, that's right, otherwise called Groundhog Day. Coming up, Christians, Buddhists, Jews, and more unite. Today is for all of you, the religious significance of Groundhog Day, the movie. We're going to talk about how the movie is really an intersection for many faiths. I'm serious. Later on this hour. You got us, babe.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This story gets you really thinking. Okay, imagine we play a game of tennis, right? We sit down and we go, man, you know what I feel like? A cold Joe Stalin.
What?
Soda. That's right. In Russia, they've started producing Joseph Stalin-logoed sodas to mark a World War II military anniversary. What would such a thing taste like? What would it look like? Why would you even reach for one? But Boris Maximov of our partner, the BBC's Russian service, joined us earlier to explain it all. I asked Boris how much rehabilitation Joseph Stalin needs, since it sounds like he's doing pretty well.
He's doing pretty well because there's been a fairly concerted campaign over the last 10 years from the authorities, from the top down, to kind of rehabilitate him. For example, you know, they changed the history school books because history is being taught as a compulsory subject for all the children in schools. And they rewrote them, and now it mentions in one sentence that he did kill quite a few people, but how many exactly is disputed. And then it stresses that he was a very effective manager. And sure, he was not perfect, but he was very good at running the country.
This is what the school books say. It doesn't say that on the drink bottle or anything.
No, but... for example, as a result of that campaign, it's been going on for almost 10 years now, or trying to rehabilitate an idea of a strong, effective leader who will save the country and move it somewhere, guess whom they're hinting at. There was the campaign to restore Stalin to at least some kind of glory. So his pictures suddenly appeared at least on one subway station in Moscow recently. One of his statues recently appeared somewhere. There was vodka called Stalin for quite a few years now. And if you listen to opinion polls, for example, in Russia, ordinary Russians are being asked who in Russian history in 20th century or 19th century was one of the main great heroes of the country, they invariably mention Stalin in the top three or four. And in the latest opinion poll on the subject, they mentioned Stalin and Solzhenitsyn at exactly the same level, which is kind of somewhat ironic because Solzhenitsyn spent his time denouncing Stalin's crimes.
Now, you know, Lenin, of course, has been a trade figure for quite a long time. Why do you think this particular brewery took, or a particular beverage manufacturer took this step?
Because they read the same opinion poll As I just quoted you, and if somebody is popular, so it's not at least among a larger section of population. It's not entirely
that I get
buying something.
No, I understand, but why are they first? Why did they step out first? Do they have a reputation for being conservative or a reputation for being edgy?
Neither. They just want to be popular. Because I told you, you know, there was Stalin vodka been around for a while, and not just in Russia. I've seen the Coca-Cola bottling plant in neighboring Georgia that produced simultaneously Coca-Cola and vodka called Stalin.
So, Boris Maximov, what does Stalin, the drink, taste like?
Well, I suspect that it tastes a lot of like any other soft drink, kind of gassy chemical.
A gassy chemical. But, I mean, is it going to be really sweet, or is it going to be sort of sour?
Of course it is sweet. Russians have a sweet tooth. You know, give enough sweetness and enough drink, and the country's happy.
So next time you go back to Moscow, you're going to bring some out?
Probably not. There are better things to take out from there.
It was Boris Maximov, BBC Russian Service editor. He joined us from Bush House in London, where he was imagining having a nice cold Stalin, a nice cold Joe Stalin.
That crisp taste.
With lunch, yes. Refresh yourself with Joe Stalin. Gassy chemical. The gassy chemical of a new generation.
Okay. Let's just stop
Keep
that
it going.
There.
I can't stop. Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee, and we begin with a question from the Book of Murray.
If you only had one day to live, what would you do with it?
That, of course, is Bill Murray from the movie Groundhog Day. We're going to talk about the significance of this Bill Murray flick. It's actually been embraced by many religions. We'll talk about why in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. President Obama will try to sell his economic agenda when he travels to New Hampshire today. While there, he'll tour a local business and hold his second town hall meeting in 6 days. The president is urging Congress to approve his nearly $4 trillion budget, which raises the deficit to $1.6 trillion. But still, the president says the budget isn't wasteful.
We've gone through every department spending, line by line, item by item, looking for inefficiency, duplication, and programs that have outlived their usefulness.
The president's budget includes $300 billion for recession relief and job creation.
Moving to Haiti now, the U.S. military will begin flying injured earthquake victims to American hospitals in several states to avoid overloading Florida. The federal government will reimburse hospitals for treatment that they provide as well. In entertainment, producer David Brown has died. David Brown was married to Cosmopolitan editor Helen Gurley Brown. He was 93, and he was nominated for the Best Picture Oscar 4 times and brought films like Jaws and A Few Good Men to the big screen. And this year's Oscar nominations are out. Some of the nominees for Best Picture, there are 10 of them, so we'll only name a few: Avatar, The Blind Side, and The Hurt Locker. And finally, winter, not over yet, if you believe Punxsutawney Phil, the weather-predicting groundhog.
As the sky shines bright above me, my shadow I see beside me. 6 more weeks of winter it will be.
Come on, the weather is all in your mind, okay? It's all in your mind. We're going to talk more about groundhogs and the movie in just a moment. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Then put your little hand in mine.
So what do you do when you're going to have a religious ceremony? You sacralize the space, listen to that music. Sacred music, no. It's Sonny and Cher, but it is the music that iconically evokes that moment at 6 a.m. when Bill Murray wakes up again and again and again in the movie Groundhog Day. It is Groundhog Day today, and the holiday is not what we're going to talk about, but the movie is something we're going to talk about because the movie has become, since it was released in 1993, something of a cult legend, and for reasons that we're going to explore. I mean, it does ask all the right questions.
Rita, if you only had one day to live, what would you do with it?
I don't know, Phil. What are you dying of?
No. I mean, the whole world is about to explode. What do?
I just want to know where to put the camera.
Asking big questions, kind of a romantic comedy, but also having this spooky sort of deja vu, it happens over and over and over again kind of special effect, transported this movie, for reasons we don't quite understand, into something way beyond simply a cult flick or a vehicle for Bill Murray. Angela Zito joins us. She's co-director of the NYU Center for Religion and Media. She's right here in the studio. Angela Zito, is this a parable of redemption, and why do religious groups identify with this text and this story?
Well, I guess I'd say the quick answer to that one would be yes. And
What's interesting is that so many different groups seem to identify with it. I myself have taught the film at the end of an Introduction to Buddhism class.
Really?
So, yes. So that is the angle at which I come to it.
But list the religions, the many religions, you say, that have adopted this story or have at least investigated.
Well, Jews seem to be very interested in it. Certainly Christians. I've heard Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog himself, you know, compared to the risen Christ sort of out of pagan traditions, you know, the rising of spring, so on.
There are origins there, absolutely,
yeah, absolutely
historical origins
that,
there. Well,
yeah.
Well, the stone tablets guy in this story is Danny Rubin, the screenwriter of Groundhog Day. He joins us from Massachusetts. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning, John.
So you didn't come down from the mountain with this screenplay, did you?
I actually did write it on a stone tablet. took a while.
Did you have any idea that this would be the result? I mean, you, Bill Murray, I don't necessarily associate you guys with, a religious cult or...
You just don't know us well enough.
I know.
No, of course not. I mean, it was just trying to be honest with the original premise of the story and being honest to the character, and that's, it was very gratifying that it was embraced by so many people in that way because we knew it wasn't just a simple comedy.
Now, how did you know it wasn't just a simple comedy? What told you that?
Well, when I came up with the idea, I wasn't interested in the premise as a simple comedy about a guy just repeating the same day, even though I knew that that was funny and had a lot of good ideas in it. It wasn't until I started thinking about people and humanity, and it was always a young man's journey through life. If a person could live long enough and unencumbered by history, what would be the result? How would they change? So at the very heart of it, it was always a very human story.
And that really is the classic core of this story, Angela Zito, someone who gets the chance to relive their life and what they might do differently. That's sort of the redemption.
Well, it certainly is about repetition, and religions think about repetition somewhat differently. Buddhists of the Mahayana Greater Vehicle Tradition, that's like Zen, Tibetan Buddhists, so
right.
on, they think that we are all here until we manage to get it right. So there will be constant reincarnation.
So there it's the repetition. The repetition is that's interesting. So it's not simply corrective, it's improvement.
It's improvement.
Interesting.
And you get the chance over and over again. First of all, to notice that you're repeating, and this is something that Bill Murray does notice. No one around Bill Murray notices that the day is repeating.
And when he finally comes to a conclusion of what the heck is going on here, here's what he concludes about himself. Listen.
I'm a god.
You're a god.
I'm a god. I'm not the god. I don't think.
Because you survived a car wreck? You folks ready to order?
I didn't just survive a wreck. I wasn't just blown up yesterday. I have been stabbed, shot, poisoned, frozen, hung, electrocuted, and burned.
Oh, really?
And every morning I wake up without a scratch on me, not a dent in the fender. I am an immortal.
So, Danny Rubin, you wrote that line. Were you thinking Job there, or were you thinking Terminator?
Oh, well, I was just thinking that was his character with his kind of ego would come to that conclusion and then kind of grow beyond it to the point where he realized, well, I may be a god, I may not be a god, it doesn't matter, I'm still stuck here. There are still limitations to what I can do.
You know, Danny, you were saying that you were just examining the character, but, you know, the funny thing for me is the place where it actually realistically becomes about a religion is that he has to get it right to a certain extent. Like, you're looking for the right answers from him before the whole roller coaster ends. He's going to keep doing it over and over again till he says the right things and does the right things. There's a right answer here.
I don't know if that's true, but it sure seems that way because of where the movie ends.
Right.
What if the movie went on for another 2 hours?
See, that's what I was afraid of when I watched it.
Really, most people enjoy it.
No, I totally enjoyed it. But I trying to imagine this repetition, I went, this feels like it might be a prison. How's he going to deal with that? Of course, you dealt with it brilliantly. Angela Zito, what is the most unusual sort of interpretation that you found in your teachings?
Apparently it is considered to be really kind of you know, a kind of mandatory viewing for Wiccans, because Groundhog Day is one of their, you know, four-time Sabbath holidays, like the holidays that come during the year between the equinox and the solstice.
Now, remind us who the Wiccans are. They're not witches.
These are people who are interested in old pagan gods of say Northern Europe.
And was that the elevator pitch, Danny Rubin? We're going to get the Wiccans when we did this movie.
That's the one that got the studio on board.
Well, it's amazing. Congratulations, Danny Rubin. Happy Groundhog Day. I imagine it's a popular holiday in your household.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Danny Rubin, the screenwriter of Groundhog Day, and Angela Zito, thanks so much for coming into the studio. She's co-director of the NYU Center for Religion and Media. Man, I had no idea that would be as interesting as it was. So I'm wondering, if Groundhog Day has been an important film to you, tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or maybe there's another film out there that's been a big part of your life. Maybe The Big Lebowski or anything else. Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We got to reach the Wiccans. Wiccans, call us.
We're also looking for your suggestions on how you help people that are unemployed. What do you offer to friends or family who've lost their jobs? Or if you are unemployed, what kind of help do you want?
This is Jim Corbett from Teaneck, New Jersey. Being that I'm unemployed, I went to a vocational counselor for advice. And he told me to try being a volunteer, that I get experience. That may be true, but with all due respect, volunteerism won't pay the bill.
Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to the website, thetakeaway.org. We're also asking you about the Super Bowl. We're teaming up with ProPublica to find out what politicians are going to the Super Bowl and how they got their tickets. Go to our website, thetakeaway.org.
You can report this, and we'll report the results on the website. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.